Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget your machete as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, anomalies, and legends. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined today by another host of this very show that you're listening to.
That would be me, Mark Matzke. I also am one of your hosts. Welcome.
Welcome. And you can find the show on most podcatchers and on 97.1 FM radio. A quick note, I should have done this last week. If you're a listener of the show and you back the Small Town Monsters Kickstarter, thank you from the bottom of my heart. This is obviously the official podcast of Small Town Monsters, the production company, and you can now find our little Monsteropolis home on the smalltownmonsters.com website, along with Sasquatch, our other show we did for a while about Bigfoot, which some people apparently don't realize is no longer a functioning show and still are trying to tell me to take the crickets out.
That is amazing. The show continues to touch lives,
yes,
you know?
Move people to converse with us.
That's quite an archive, though, you know, when you go back and look.
Oh, by the time...
Like hours and hours.
You got so much... You got all an entire show about Bigfoot that we did for 4 years? 3 years?
Three and a half, four years.
And then you're going to have... This is episode 23, I believe, of Monsteropolis already. So we're coming up on like we're past that, or we're coming up on like the half year anniversary episode. That'll be sometime in the next couple months. My goal for this show is to hit 1,000 episodes. So we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. But
we'll be 70 years old.
Yeah,
still talking about
unexplained. At this point, it's more than likely. We have a letter today. From a listener, Zachariah Barton wrote in, if you want to write in, monsteropolismail@gmail.com is where you can send your questions, comments, concerns about the lack of crickets, to monsteropolismail@gmail.com. Hello there, gentlemen. Just wanted to drop a quick note to say that I'm enjoying the show. Are you all considering an episode on unidentified submerged objects? Not sure if I can recall if that particular subject was covered, and I just missed it. Thanks, and keep up the good work. A listener in Texas, Zachariah. I'd love to, because that's actually one of my favorite ufological topics is USOs. So it's definitely on our radar. We'll definitely get to it.
Ivan Sanderson has a book about those, I think. That would give me an excuse to... Mm-hmm. Invest.
Which books? I've got Sanderson's Uninvited Guests. Is that what it's called?
Yes, and okay. there's some in there, but I thought that he had one that was just completely dedicated to that subject. But maybe I'm thinking of somebody else.
I got that one because it had the Flatwoods case,
yes,
written about in it.
Yeah,
and that was all part of my research for. I had such lofty plans for my research for this week's show, and I had even talked to you about like I was the one that was like 2 weeks ago. I was like, let's get started on this now, man.
I was duly impressed. Like, wow.
Yeah, I started this morning at 8 a.m. by watching a documentary about D.B. Cooper, and we didn't even really talk about D.B.
No,
Cooper, so
I know.
But this week we are talking about a subject that is simultaneously one of my favorite and one of my least favorite paranormal subjects, which is alien abduction.
Okay.
Did I not tell you the right?
No, I thought I was kidnapped.
Kidnapped, I can't even get to because I didn't do any research for that one.
Okay.
We'll hit Kidnapped. Actually, that's probably something Brandon would like to talk about with us.
Okay.
What do you have, the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, I had to translate them, but cool. Here they are.
I didn't know there was abduction.
Yeah.
is this
out of
wheel?
The Qumran community of Essene scholarship.
I've got just four cases here. Apparently, listeners are going to have to hear my text notifications going off because I can't figure out how to turn that off when I'm in Bluetooth mode on this mixer we got. Okay, so I've just got a few things to talk about, and it's stuff you're going to want to chime in on. But I have to start. So if we're doing this chronologically, I have to start with this case that I found, and hopefully you've got some input on this. I don't know if you're even aware of this, but H.G. Shaw from 1926. You ever hear? Or 18... Wait a minute. 1896. I was close.
No.
So this is our mystery airship.
Okay.
With our mystery airship wave that we did an entire show about. This is one that could have been in there that maybe we did talk about, and I'm just blanking on it. But this was this is H.G. Shaw in 1896. So as we talked about, during 1896 and 1897, there was what was known as a mystery airship wave that spread across the United States of people seeing these mysterious objects in the sky that seemed to be similar to what we would term today as a UFO or just a blimp. But there's a couple articles on this. So H.G. Shaw might actually technically be termed as the sort of first alien abductee of the modern era, or attempted abductee. And this was during that mystery airship ways. But these are both. So this is an article from a newspaper near. I'm suddenly blanking on the name, but it's California. It's near Stockton, California. But the actual town where it took place is another name. It's frustrating. Lodi. That's what it is. It's frustrating because there's a Lodi right over here. For listeners, I was pointing behind me to Mark.
In the general direction.
Yeah. Okay, so the article starts off, I took a couple days off last week. It's So Missed National Alien Abduction Day, March 20th. Believe it or not, which is actually for us in just a few days, fitting. Believe it or not, Stockton has a significant place in alien abduction studies. According to experts, ufologists, or whatever they call themselves, the first documented case of attempted alien abduction occurred, yes, outside Stockton. The following story is chronicled not only in books such as Alien Contacts and Abductions by Jenny Randles, but also in Pioneer Stockton newspapers. The headline read, "Who possibly came from the planet Mars? Three strange visitors seen on a country road by Colonel H.G. Shaw and a companion." That was the headline of the Stockton Evening Mail of November 25th, 1896. According to the Mail, this Colonel Shaw, a former editor at the Mail, and a young man named Camille Spooner, were riding a horse-drawn buggy back from Lodi. It was dark. We were jogging along quietly when the horse stopped suddenly and gave a snort of terror, Shaw said. Looking up, we beheld three strange beings. They resembled humans in many respects, but still were not like anything I had ever seen. They were nearly, or quite, 7 feet high and very slender. These beings wore no clothing, Shaw reported. Instead, they were covered with a natural growth hard to describe. It was not hair, neither was it like feathers, but it was as soft as silk to the touch. Shaw sensed the silken strangers meant no harm. They seemed to take great interest in ourselves, the horse and buggy, and scrutinized everything very carefully. Shaw approached them. Their faces and head were without hair, the ears were very small, and the nose had the appearance of polished ivory, Shaw said. Their mouths were tiny, while the eyes were large and lustrous. Shaw added, they were possessed of a strange and indescribable beauty. Ever the newsman, Shaw asked the aliens where they were from. They seemed not to understand me, but began warbling, expressing it better than talking. Shaw touched one of them. Placing my hand under his elbow, I pressed gently upward, and lo and behold, I lifted him from the ground with scarcely an effort. I should judge that the specific gravity of the creature was less than an ounce. Each alien carried a shoulder bag attached to a nozzle. Every little while, one or the other would place the nozzle on his mouth, at which time I heard a sound of escaping gas. Here's where Stockton entered the annals of alien abduction lore, inaugurated the annals, in fact. One of them, at a signal from one who appeared to be the leader, attempted to lift me, probably with the intention of carrying me away, Shaw said. But the aliens failed. Although I made not the slightest resistance, he could not move me, and finally the three of them tried it without the slightest success. Whipping out egg-shaped lights, some sort of luminous mineral, the beings revealed a startling, immense airship hovering nearby. It was 150 feet in length, at least, though probably not over 20 feet in diameter, pointed at both ends, and outside of a large rudder, there was no visible machinery. Off to the ship they headed, not as you or I walk, but with a swaying motion, their feet only touching the ground at intervals of about 15 feet. Springing 20 feet up to the ship, the aliens whizzed off. It went through the air very rapidly and expanded and contracted with a muscular motion and was soon out of sight. And that is how Stockton became a charter member of the Alien Abduction Club. You ever hear that?
I've never heard that
before. I had never heard that before today. I was extremely excited to discover this story, especially because it's tied to that mystery airship episode we did, which I actually really enjoyed that topic. We talked about revisiting that at some point in a different context. Well, we're revisiting it here in a way I never would have expected, you know, with like the first attempted abduction by very light aliens.
Right. So that, I mean, it's interesting that he tried to lift them first, right?
Yeah.
He tried to lift them and then they tried to lift him.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
They might be saying this was an attempted human abduction.
They could, right.
Like, we went to their plane. This guy tried to pick us up and carry us off. They were probably just trying to defend themselves.
Yeah. I mean, it suggests a couple things. I mean, is a failed attempt.
Mm-hmm.
So if the other stories are true, like maybe they went back to the drawing board and were like,
you know what? We need a beam and some probes.
Right.
We're good.
We'll show them.
Yeah.
Heavy human people.
Yeah. Let's go back.
That's wild, though. I've never heard. Where was that from?
So Stockton, California. The story I was reading.
Is it the early edge of the airship?
Yeah. 1896.
Mm-hmm.
Did I say March or November? I know it was in a November paper, but I thought it said March. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that would be right in line with the mystery airship wave that we did that whole episode on.
Yeah, and that's so interesting too. It's unusual in the sense that it involved that sort of, he felt like he was being grabbed to be taken away.
Well,
because when you get a little bit later into the 20th century, the first wave of interaction is based around common meetings as opposed to abductions. You know, it's a whole contactee versus abductee.
Like they were attempting to take him. The mm-hmm. other thing about it that I thought is really interesting is that the way he describes the ship appearing overhead is they basically press a button, all of a sudden it appears in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely not in line with any of the other mystery airships. There's nothing where, you know, like it's basically transparent, you know, it's got some sort of cloaking device like the Predator ship or something.
Right. I mean, typically it seems like a solid object. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are tying it to the ground with ropes and things.
Unfortunately, the incident happened to a newspaper man. And typically when what I'm discovering is that when you've got a report from the 1800s or even the early 1900s that involve a newspaper man claiming to witness something very unusual, typically seems to be that they're just really trying to get that mm-hmm. to get that big money.
Oh yeah,
the big money,
the big newspaper money.
The 1800 newspaper money.
So with the abduction phenomena, you know, this really moves into the public consciousness beginning about the mid-60s. You know, where the abduction really takes center stage. Before that, and in shows that we've done already, you know, really kicks off, of course, in the 40s with the flying saucer wave initiated by Kenneth Arnold's sighting. Mm-hmm. And the focus is on, you know, nuts and bolts, ships, what are these things? And then relatively rapidly, you get into interaction with, you know, presumably what's driving the ships, and that's the contactee wave, mm-hmm. where people are invited to come aboard ships or meet with various alien races. They do so, and it's all voluntary. They go on rides to other worlds in some cases, but there's never a sense that they're being taken against their will.
Darren Berger, kind of the perfect example. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then are you going to Betty and Barney?
Yes.
Okay.
I thought that would be
that's a good perfect spot.
Place.
Yeah. I have a little sound clip here, actually. So this is slightly creepy, in all honesty. This is from the actual hypnosis session that was conducted with them. This creeped me right out. So if you're a listener who's easily frightened by things, just a warning. Also, the sound quality here is very bad. I found this on the Wikipedia. It was found on Wikipedia, but it's on the UFO Finding UFO YouTube channel. It's where you can find the entire 40 plus minutes of the initial hypnosis session with Betty and Barney Hill, who are claimed to be sort of the first, or one of the first anyway, in the modern era UFO abductees.
Anxious or distressed, but you will remember everything and you will tell me everything.
Yes. I think I will stop. I will stop. And I have not stopped. And Betty said, look, there's a star moving. And I look and I see a star. Funny. But I said, Betty, that's a satellite. We are seeing a satellite. And then I pulled over to the side of the road. And Betty jumped off her side, on her side, with the binoculars. And I got the chain. And I hooked it to the dog on her collar, and I say, come on, Delcy, let's get out. She jumps out, and I look toward the sky, and I look back to Delcy, and walk her around the trunk of the car, and I'm saying, hurry up, Betty, so I can get a look. And Betty passes the binoculars to me. And I see that this is not a satellite. It is an airplane. It is an airplane. You can see, I think, you can see the rows of windows.
So this thing gets super creepy. Have you ever listened to it before?
No, this is the first.
Yeah. Eventually, Betty starts giving her account, and she gets to the point where she's screaming, and, I mean, like, it gets real pretty quick. So if you can get the chance, actually go on YouTube and find that video. We'll link to it in the show notes for this episode as well. Very educational and almost like a counter to Woodrow Derenberger's interview following his run-in with Indrid Cold. His is just so matter-of-fact, and theirs is horrifying. Like, they're both, he's crying, and, like, she's weeping and screaming, and it's some very unsettling stuff.
One thing that I don't recall is Derenberger, did he recall his memories consciously, or was he ever hypnotized?
I don't know if he was hypnotized. His initial interview was not hypnotized. He was okay. Just doing an interview with a radio station.
Right.
Yeah. And it was all very conscious.
Because that is at the heart of the abduction phenomena, and is the issue of hypnosis.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about in the next episode. So we're doing, this is technically a two-part episode. This episode, we're kind of just running through some of the abduction stories. And then the next episode, we're going to talk about the lasting effects of the abductions. And I've got some things to talk about in that episode regarding, like, hypnosis and implants and the psychology behind it and things like that. Mm-hmm. Do you want to give a quick overview of the Betty and Barney Hill?
Sure. I mean, really, really briefly, I mean, they were traveling through New Hampshire and it was nighttime. And as you heard in the clip, they saw what they thought was a plane at first, a satellite, then a plane. It kept approaching them. It was kind of tracking their car. And that's really what got their attention in the first place, was this growing sense that it's not just some natural phenomena or man-made object that has nothing to do with them, but there seemed to be intent involved with that was located on them. And finally, it led to them driving off the main road and encountering a party of about 5 foot tall entities with large hairless heads, grayish skin, large slanted eyes, slit mouths, and in many ways resembling what we have come to know today as the alien grays. They were escorted by these beings that communicated with them evidently in a telepathic manner, and they lapsed into kind of a lethargic state, entered a UFO that was landed in the woods. Once inside, they were submitted to discrete medical examinations for Betty that included a needle in the abdomen. Betty also saw a star map that figures into their story very prominently while she was waiting for the beings to kind of finish up with Barney. And then they were released with a warning from the leader, the lead alien, to forget. And even as they watched the UFO take off, their memory started to fade. By the time they got home, they had forgotten the 2 hours of their captivity, just keeping a vague sense that something more had happened. So this is very, very foundational in terms of abduction stories, because it has just about every important beat that would factor into abduction tales to come, including the sense of missing time, being against their will, like losing their volition, and just being either levitated or taken aboard a ship, experimented on, having some type of interaction, probably mentally, with the beings. And then afterwards, there's a sense of missing time, that we ended up back where we started, but significant time has passed.
And the story itself has become one of the most famous UFO stories. I mean, there was obviously elements of it that inspired Spielberg with Close Encounters of the Third Kind. There was elements of it that have probably inspired multiple horror movies related to aliens ever since. And then there was a 1977 movie, television made for TV movie about Betty and Barney Hill that's supposed to be pretty good. I just saw Michael Huntington post about it the other day. Do you know, did they ever claim any other sightings or anything after this?
I believe so.
Did they?
I think so. I'll look that up in a second. Okay. The TV movie that you're talking about,
yeah,
aired on October 20th, 1975.
Okay.
16 days before Travis Walton disappeared.
Ooh, hey.
Just saying.
We'll get to him in a second.
Yeah.
I'm curious, actually, to hear your opinion on Walton, because we've actually hung out with him.
You were in a limousine with him.
Limousine, yeah.
If I recall correctly.
Happy days. Yeah, the Betty and Barney Hill thing is to me has always been very disturbing. The emotional toll it seemed to take on them seemed to be pretty strong. There were people that examined them at the time who felt they were telling the truth. Of course, they were trying to come up with contrary views. They were taken by aliens or a UFO. There was this idea that maybe they had sort of a shared dream about their abduction. And you know, that's why so many of their views lined up with one another. But their description of the aliens is very much the alien gray, what we've kind of come to, you know, to know as an alien. The most classic view of aliens, which is always disturbingly similar to the lamb, We'll talk about that eventually.
Well, another feature, and I think what makes their story so compelling, is that their character seems to have been unimpeachable. Mm-hmm. I mean, these were super...
He was super intelligent.
Too. They were both... it was a mixed-race couple. I don't know if people always realize that. And they were both highly involved in the civil rights movement.
Yeah, this was at a time where that was not common.
Right.
Yeah.
And just nothing about either of them that seemed like it lent itself at all to confabulation or making up a story for the sake of... there's nothing for them to gain, it would seem to me, by getting this story out there. As far as their other causes were concerned, it seemed to be harmful.
Yeah.
So the fact that they did and they stood behind their story just suggests that to them this was absolutely a real experience.
Yeah. Do we want to talk about Walton? Did you have more about Betty and Barney you wanted to
answer? Well, I think one thing that, you know, skeptics of the story like to point to is that there was a TV science fiction program that aired sometime around, you know, approximately the same time as the Hill abduction, that gave a somewhat prototypical alien gray portrayal on screen. And some have suggested that the Hill's description of the aliens changed over time, that it could have been subconsciously influenced by the TV show. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to make of that necessarily. And of course, the other thing is, their recollection of the event was, as we heard, largely due to a hypnotic regression. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the skeptical questions about that, you know, tend to focus on, was it some sort of shared dream or shared hallucination? Skeptics of the skeptics say, well, that's strange because they don't share exactly in all the details and they were taken to different parts of the ship. And how do you...
Right.
How do you dream that part of the shared dream? You know, but it just goes around and around, of course, as people put their spin on, you know, their opinion of the story.
Points to all the things I find creepy about alien abductions. Mm-hmm. Similar to this next, so Travis Walton, this is an audio clip from the Larry King, actually, which I found on...
He doesn't need that reassurance.
On the...
they said I hit the ground YouTube's limp, and they thought it killed me. So
they left.
They left.
Out of fright, too.
Yes.
Now, what happened to you? What do you remember?
I was missing for 5 days and 6 hours before I woke up on the roadway outside of Heber. That's a little town near where this happened.
Do you have lots of memories of those 5 days?
Not lots. Actually, less than 20 minutes. It's a very difficult thing to recall.
Did you go somewhere with them?
Yes, apparently.
To?
I don't know.
Did you take off? I mean, do you remember it taking off?
When I was returned, I saw it take off.
When you were returned, obviously. So the most famous sort of, for me anyway, not most famous, but the best UFO movie based on a real event is Fire in the Sky. In my humble opinion, I don't know how you feel. I mean, Close Encounters is drawing from different real events, but it's not directly based on it. And most of the time, like, paranormal movies based on real events aren't great. But Fire in the Sky holds up. And it's, I actually watched it for the first time like 2 years ago. Still super creepy. And I really like the lead actor too. The guy from Cutting Edge or whatever that movie is called. but great movie. What Travis Walton, so we were with Travis last year. Last September at IBC International Bigfoot Conference. Seems like a very nice, quiet guy. Doesn't seem like he's out to, you know, capture a bunch of attention for himself. Seems very reserved, and, you know, he's not running around bragging about his UFO abduction case. What is your read on, well, were you aware of Travis Walton as a kid, like growing up? Is this something you grew up with?
Yeah.
Were you?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. He, and that's amazing, that clip that you played with Larry King, because evidently that was recorded before he was hypnotized or started remembering things. Mm-hmm. Because there he claims to not remember hardly anything, but he would go on to remember a lot about his experiences. My impression of him out in Washington is much as yours. I reserved, very quiet. And to me, he almost, and this is probably reading into it, but he seemed haunted in a way. Mm-hmm. Like he was there with people, but like a step removed. And I don't know if that's just another conference to go to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
From his perspective.
Yeah.
Or if it was, I don't know, if that he's so been so affected by what happened that he's just sort of like looks at reality completely differently.
Mm-hmm.
But he struck me as somebody who seemed like he was always thinking about something else, I guess.
Did you watch the movie when it came out?
No, it was much later. I was scared. I didn't want to see it.
That's the way with me. I've always avoided it. Like I said, abductions terrify me. That the idea of something being able to come into your room and take you at any moment, you know, has always been one of the scarier aspects of ufology for me. I like thinking about UFOs in the sky and strange lights and all that stuff, but when you get into the actual like interaction with them, it takes on a different tone for me. And this part of the subject has always scared me more than any of them. Probably we'll get into the reasons why much more in the next episode, but just the idea of something intruding into your space and being able to take you without you doing anything about it has always been terrifying.
And it's pretty obvious to me too that this is what took over ufology
mm-hmm.
in the 80s and 90s. I mean, it pretty much, I mean, there's always been reports of UFOs and the lights in the skies and the movement of the craft. But, you know, really starting with Betty and Barney Hill, there was a gap in time. And then in the middle, late 70s, it just started to snowball to where in the 80s and 90s, really the field was consumed with abduction cases.
And there's similarities to the Bigfoot subject with like interaction and people mm-hmm. claiming interaction,
yes,
becoming
right.
becoming the thing that's at the forefront rather than trying to actually, you know, like go out and find these things for ourselves. Is that they're finding us and they're taking us and I'm having some sort of relationship with the Bigfoot. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with
communication,
yeah.
Right? I mean, so should we thumbnail the Walton case?
Yeah, real quick.
Okay. So this was November 5th.
Now that we've talked about it for 15
minutes. November 5th, 1975, six Arizona woodcutters reported a seventh member of their crew, Travis Walton, had disappeared as he approached a hovering UFO. And as you heard in the clip, for 5 days, he was gone. A 5 day search parties failed to locate Walton. Coworkers stuck to their story despite suspicions they had murdered him. Oh. That part gets forgotten often. And on the fifth day after his disappearance, a dehydrated and confused Travis Walton reappeared and recounted fragmentary memories of small gray beings with large eyes, tall blonde humans of oddly similar appearance, and this is my favorite part, a vast hangar-like room where several UFOs rested.
Mm.
Several other abductions occurred around the same time. Famous one in Maine that's really creepy. We might be able to talk about at some point. But again, skeptics noted the proximities of Walton's claim to an NBC TV movie based on the Hill case airing on October 20th, 1975, 16 days before Walton's disappearance. The Moody report surfaced prior to the broadcast. Others that followed it fell under suspicion of being inspired by the movie and the uproar over Walton. So that too is an element of the abduction phenomena, is the age-old question of does one or two famous reports, especially those covered extensively in media, give rise to other purported experiences, or do they just open the floodgates for people to feel okay to talk about them? Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of the chicken and the egg of these type of cases.
What's this main thing?
Essentially, two men who were camping were out really late and begin to essentially be stalked by a UFO before they are abducted. And it just the whole story of them kind of moving, they both get in a pickup truck and they're driving around, and there's this sort of railroad car shaped light that comes down to their level and is like tracking them and through the woods even. It's really... It's pretty startling. And then the fallout of that being that one of the abductees kind of goes on the record about their experiences and the other wants nothing to do with that. And it kind of creates a rift between the two guys.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Walton case is weird too, because it's got such a, well, like you said, similarities to the Betty and Barney Hill case, but it's got, this is sort of the prototypical abduction case, because they're experimenting on him and they're running tests and whatever you want to call it. And it's almost torture. It verges on like torture, and it had lasting effects on Travis and on his psyche and all that kind of stuff. So in the next episode, we're going to get into physical effects and psychological effects of purported alien abductions as well. So do you want to wrap us up on abductions? Did you have anything else you wanted to hit?
No.
In your scrolls?
Yeah, the scrolls hold much yet to be portrayed.
Matsky scrolls.
Yes.
A spinoff of Monsteropolis.
No, but I think the kind of the main point for this episode, I think that it gets the ball rolling, is the idea that, you know, abduction cases, as I said before, really became the one thing above everything else in the 80s and 90s. We haven't even talked about Whitley Strieber. And you know, so that
it's funny, because I have some notes on him that are in the next episode. It's more of the debunking stuff I've been looking at, but
yeah. And I guess the one thing about abductions that you have, anyone trying to explain it, either pro or con, or, you know, there's various schools of thought, you know, you have the materialistic explanation. In other words, this really actually happened. Someone was taken aboard a real life craft and was really experimented on and then taken home. Then you have sort of paranormal explanations. You have then debunkers, obviously. But the main thing is that, and also social psychological explanations. But at the end of it all is the sense that what these people are describing is so uniform that's the key. That's where either you're trying to prove that as true, or you have to explain that away. And that is that people from hugely different walks of life, most of it North America, but also internationally, are having the same experience. They're walking through the same experience of seeing something in the sky. Either they get hit by a beam from it, or it comes down to their level against their will. They're taken aboard the craft. Some type of experiment takes place. There's some level of communication they have with whatever has abducted them. They are then taken back to at least near the place where the encounter began. There appears in most cases to be a mind wipe of some sort that happens. And only later on do memories start to surface, and especially if some type of hypnosis is undergone, do these memories start to resurface in detail. And so the question becomes, if that's really happening, who's doing it and why? If that's not really happening and that's just a psychological or social explanation, why that ritual? You know, why that progression of events that seem to be so specific and so consistently experienced? Everyone is still left with a kind of a huge shrug of the shoulders. As much as abductions were thought to be the key that would unlock ufology and what are UFOs, we still don't really know.
If you like the show, leave us a rating and review on iTunes, Google Play, whatever you're listening on. If we are not on a podcatcher that you like to use, let us know which it is, and we will do our best to get the show up on those avenues. Visit our Facebook page, Twitter, and don't forget to send your letters to monsteropolismail@gmail.com.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.